This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Falling oil prices, debt talks blowing up, a deal in Greece, Wall Street down hard and then up. Was it just me, or was there a lot going on today? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday today, the 23rd of June. Glad you could be with us. And I'll tell you, this rarely happens, but I actually had some doubts today about where to start. Talks on the debt limit blowing up, oil prices tumbling, stocks doing the same until there was news of a debt deal in Greece, J.K. Rowling and Pottermore. Okay, no, I was never really going to do Harry Potter unless she'd said there was an eighth book coming out. So in the end, I went with oil. Crude prices took a nosedive today, down 6% after the International Energy Agency and the White House each announced they're going to sell off some of their strategic petroleum reserves. There wasn't much explanation as to the logic of the whole thing in those announcements, so we called up Sarah Emerson. She's the president of Energy Security Analysis up in Wakefield, Massachusetts. Sarah, welcome to the program.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
Why now with this release?
Why now? Because they didn't do it 3 months ago.
Explain that a little bit.
Well, when the Libyan oil production went offline, you could credibly say there was a disruption to the oil market, and this is what strategic reserves are used for, to respond to that kind of emergency. But I think there were a number of reasons why they didn't respond at that time. I think there was some concern that the Arab Spring might result in other supply disruptions. I think there was a recognition that oil demand was at its seasonal low. But I would also add that there was a little bit of naivete about what do we use these things for.
One assumes, and maybe this is just a wrong assumption, that they're doing it to drive down prices. Or is it a confidence-building measure?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. I think you have to go back to the reason for strategic reserves. They are not an economic lever. And that's why the statements that have been made by both the IEA and the United States is we're responding to the ongoing supply disruption from Libya. You could begin to connect the dots and say, well, we also have heard some bad economic news. The oil prices have been very high. So if you start to connect those dots, you begin to think that maybe it's more than just Libya. I think we got to be a little bit careful in not creating a conspiracy theory.
This is 30 million barrels from us, 30 million barrels from the IEA, 60 million total, obviously. That's what the United States uses in like 2.5 days. How much good can it really do?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that this is not about replacing or augmenting supply just for the United States. It's really targeted at a very specific volume that would have come normally from Libya. And it's also a very specific kind of crude. It's a light, sweet crude. So by reducing the reserve, the U.S. government can put a light, sweet crude into the market in the Gulf Coast. And at the same time, the IEA can put light, sweet petroleum products into the market in Europe.
Petroleum products versus crude. I gather you said that because there's a difference between what we will release and what the Europeans will release?
Yes. And let's also talk a little bit about the word release.
Okay.
In the case of the United States, release makes it sound as if we're sort of pouring it into the market. Basically, all it means is that the DOE puts 30 million barrels up for sale. Then companies can bid to purchase that crude.
So if you want it, come get it, right?
If you want it, come get it.
And just to be clear, we hold crude. The Europeans hold distillates, right? Petroleum, gas, fuel, stuff that's already been distilled.
Yes, they hold predominantly gasoline and diesel.
Sarah Emerson, the president of Energy Security Analysis in Wakefield, Massachusetts. Sarah, thanks a lot.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Till about mid-morning today in the nation's capital, it seemed like debt reduction talks were moving right along. Whispers were that a deal to cut $2 trillion from the budget over 10 years in exchange for an increase in the debt limit was close at hand. Then House Republicans changed their mind, and that effectively kicks things upstairs. It leaves Speaker John Boehner, President Obama, and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid to pick up the pieces, if they can. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has that story.
The economy has hit a soft patch just as Washington is trying to get its spending under control. Many Democrats say reining in the government is fine in the long term.
But cutting spending right now is not going to be good for our economy.
Heather Boucher is senior economist with the left-leaning Center for American Progress. She says the economy is struggling to pull itself out of recession, and a government pullback right now will only make things worse.
The conversation that we should be having is what's going to create jobs over the next 6 months to a year or 2 years.
A group of Senate Democrats is trying to steer the debt ceiling negotiations in that direction. They're holding out for some job-stimulating spending in the deal. Their ideas include money for retraining workers, highway and construction projects, and a tax cut for employers who hire new workers. But Andy LaPerrier at ISI Group doubts any Republicans will go along with more government stimulus right now.
Just because when you're sitting down and trying to cut $2 trillion from the deficit over the next 10 years, if you start including measures that cost a couple hundred or even several hundred billion dollars in terms of increasing the deficit, it makes it a lot harder to reach your target.
But should the economy still be struggling come fall, LaPerrier expects those deficit reduction targets will be put on hold while the government tries once again to prime the pump. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Google is, in the truest sense of the word, ubiquitous when it comes to internet searches. There's a reason. It's a verb, right? But there is also a noun that fits pretty well today, Target. The Wall Street Journal reported this morning that the Federal Trade Commission is about to serve Google with subpoenas and launch a formal probe into its anti-competitive practices. In English, that's antitrust. And if past government antitrust cases are any guide, this story is going to be with us for a while. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has the story.
Here's how big Google is. It handles more than half of U.S. search traffic and collects at least 75% of the ad revenue that search generates. Joanna O'Connell is an analyst at Forrester Research.
They are almost a required player for marketers that are running search campaigns. I mean, you can't really do it without Google.
But having a monopoly isn't against the law. You have to use it to unfair advantage. Scott Cleland is a research consultant who's testified against Google in Congress, and his clients include Google competitors.
And what the FTC is looking into is have they unfairly leveraged that monopoly to punish potential competitors putting their products and their services number one in the ranking. And why that's significant is 34% of people click on the top result.
So a website like Yelp that's designed to search for restaurants may come up below a restaurant search result from Google Places. Same for YouTube, which Google owns, if I want to find a video. Rupert Goodwins, editor of ZDNet UK, expects Google will defend itself as it has in a similar antitrust case in Europe, saying it can't rig the results.
It's all done by computer. There isn't any way that they could put this sort of bias in, which means Google revealing the details of how it does its searches.
And so far, Google's kept its secret search algorithm in a black box. But to defend itself, it may have to give a peek to the FTC. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, anybody know the Greek for dodged a bullet? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Wildfires are still burning across big chunks of Arizona. That includes the Wallow Fire, which has so far ripped through more than 800 square miles of mountains in that state. Those kinds of mega fires are increasingly common across the West, and it costs a lot of money to help protect forests before the fire actually strikes. Question is, as it always is, who's going to pay for it? From KNAU in Flagstaff, Claudine LaMonaco looks at one potential solution.
The trouble with the forests of northern Arizona begins from the ground up.
The floor of this forest is composed of several inches of pine needles, and these are pine needles that have accumulated over a century. You have to work your way down before you even get to the soil.
That's Taylor McKinnon, an environmentalist with the Center for Biological Diversity. He also points out the trees, 10 times as many as there should be. A century of suppressing natural fires created this overgrown forest. Now, when fire starts, the pine needles and smaller trees act as kindling, funneling flames up to the crowded treetops above. And then...
all of a sudden, hell breaks loose.
That's Pascal Berlioux. He stands beside McKinnon, pointing up to the towering ponderosa pines.
If you're on a good wind, that fire is then going to jump from canopy to canopy and essentially destroys the entire place.
Spreading catastrophic fires for miles. It's exactly what's happening right now with the Wallow Fire, 150 miles southeast of here. Berlioux is a French-born timber magnate. He and McKinnon, the environmentalist, make an unusual pair, but they're part of a team of former enemies who've come together to save northern Arizona's forest before catastrophic fires burn it down. The project would thin the forest and restore its natural ecosystem. That includes frequent, low-burning grass fires. It would also create hundreds of long-term jobs and get business to pay for it all. That's where Berlioux comes in.
You would probably get rid of all this small diameter stuff.
Berlioux's plan is to let the big trees grow, but cut down the overcrowded small trees. He'll turn that wood into what's called oriented strand board, or OSB. It's like plywood made out of wood chips, and it's a lucrative business, which is a good thing. Officials plan to protect 2.4 million acres of forest. It's the largest restoration project ever attempted and could cost up to $1 billion.
There is no way this money is coming from D.C. There is no way an increase of fishing license or hunting license can pay for that. We have to design an economy that can pay for restoration. And that's what we're doing.
Conservation groups will guide the thinning and restoration, and the U.S. Forest Service will oversee the work. It's taken years to build up the sprawling coalition of environmentalists, industry, and government. It's even more remarkable, given the personal histories of those involved.
There was a time when I probably wouldn't have given you a nickel to sit in the same room with some of the guys from Center of Biological Diversity.
That's Navajo County Supervisor David Tenney talking about McKinnon's environmental group. In the 1800s, Tenney's great-great-grandfather brought the first sawmill to Arizona. In the 1990s, the Center for Biological Diversity destroyed the family business when it shut down Arizona's logging industry to protect the Mexican spotted owl.
And now, I not only sit in the same room with him, I consider him friends.
Tenney's one of the project's most vocal supporters. It's something he could never have imagined 10 years ago. But that was before the 2002 Rodeo Chedisky fire. It burned nearly 500,000 acres and 400 homes. Thousands of people, including Tenney, were evacuated.
The fire departments, when they would come into a subdivision that they knew was in danger, they would put a flag in the tree in front of your house. You know, a green flag meant we can defend this property. A yellow flag meant we'll try, but we don't know if we can do it. And I remember when we came back in that day, we come driving into the driveway and hanging right there in our oak tree right in front of the house is a red flag. And that's when it hit home.
The fire convinced Tenney something needed to be done, but he wasn't sure what until he met Pascal Berlioux. Berlioux had just moved to Flagstaff with his family when the Rodeo Chedisky fire broke out. The fire got Berlioux thinking. Could an OSB plant save the forests that lured him here? Taylor McKinnon says Berlioux won over environmentalists by opening his books to them.
And nobody's ever done that before.
This project is a major shift for the U.S. Forest Service. Project head Henry Provencio says that for decades, the agency treated the forests like a commodity, valuing logging over conservation. Provencio says it's largely why forests are in such bad shape today.
We often pay for the sins of our past. We pay for that in terms of public trust.
He says he hopes the project will restore that trust along with the forest. Work is scheduled to begin this fall. In Flagstaff, I'm Claudine Monaco for Marketplace.
Coming up, Dubai dabbles in free trade zones.
You know, you're going to be using the airlines, you're going to be using the hotels, your partners are going to be using the accommodations.
And nobody's paying any taxes. But first, let's do the numbers. As we mentioned earlier, the IEA and the U.S. government coordinated to release 60 million barrels of oil from their strategic reserves. And so that initially sent the Dow Industrials down 260 points, but investors shook off those concerns on news of a Greek debt deal. The Dow finished down only 59 points today, about a half percent, 12,050 the number. The NASDAQ rose 17 points, 2/3%, wrapped up at 2686. The S&P 500 ticked down 3 points, 1/4%, 1283 at the bell. The price of oil drained to $91 a barrel, as I mentioned, 6%, down more than $4 today after President Obama made that petroleum announcement. Chevron and ExxonMobil leaked 1.7% today. ConocoPhillips dipped 0.4%. Cheaper oil was a pick-me-up for airlines, though, as it usually is. AMR, the parent company of American Airlines, rose 5.2%. United and U.S. Airways each soared about 5% higher today. Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase lost more than 1.5% apiece. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.92%. That is, need I say it, quite low. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for May. A House committee discusses bats. It reviews efforts to contain a deadly bat fungus. The creatures contribute to the agricultural industry through insect control and pollination. And it's about encouraging pet adoption and a little fun. Tomorrow is Take Your Dog to Work Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The European plane maker Airbus has been trouncing rival Boeing at the Paris Air Show this week. Airbus announced the biggest single order for commercial aircraft ever today, 200 planes. So far this week, it's got firm orders in hand for almost 600 new jets, compared to Boeing's rather measly score of 47. From the European desk in London, Stephen Beard sent this report.
I would just like to say that we at Airbus are extremely proud to be AirAsia's partner.
The sound of a plane maker on cloud nine. Airbus chief Tom Enders has just sold a record 200 narrow-bodied jets to a fast-growing Malaysian carrier. He sold another 180 planes to an Indian airline yesterday. Aviation analyst John Strickland says Airbus has certainly stolen a march on Boeing.
The Asian market is one of the strongest growing markets in the world, so the manufacturers want to be in there getting as big orders as they can.
Airbus clinched today's deal by installing a far more fuel-efficient engine on an existing plane, the A320. Boeing, meanwhile, is still pondering whether to do the same and upgrade its 737 jet or to build a completely new aircraft. But that would take time. Today's deal, says Strickland, shows that some airlines can't wait.
It really underlines the pressure which is on all airlines around the world at the moment to find ways of cutting the cost of operation, namely the use of fuel, given the expected long-term increase in the price of aviation fuel.
Boeing, says aviation consultant Mike Boyd, has missed a trick with the airlines.
The reality of it is, anything that says they're going to save fuel, they're going to buy. Boeing is now way behind the curve.
He says Boeing will have to move fast to avoid falling way behind its old rival Airbus. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The residential housing market may be well-nigh paralyzed, but on the somewhat brighter side, commercial real estate has been looking up. Parts of it, anyhow. Office space and apartment buildings in particular. Retail spaces, less bright. Big box stores especially are struggling with what to do with all those tens of thousands of square feet that aren't making the money that they used to. Today, Best Buy became the latest chain to consider walling off and subleasing parts of its existing stores. Marketplace's Jeff Horwich reports.
So you're shopping for a stereo or a smartphone or a Wii Fit or whatever, and suddenly it hits you. I want some lunch or a haircut or some cheap wine from Trader Joe's. Best Buy hasn't said just what kind of roommates it's looking for, but Morningstar analyst RJ Hottovy says subleasing is a way of creating a smaller store without actually building one.
And
Best Buy's case, they may be looking to sublease to a smaller specialty electronics retailer, or you may put a coffee shop in there or something. So it's a way to make your square footage more productive.
Best Buy's sales are up, but a lot of them are online. Hatavi says the company needs to trim up to a quarter of its retail space. But once a big box like Best Buy walls off a chunk of the store, will anybody want to move in? After all, retail's in a slump. Commercial real estate expert Herb Towsley at the University of St. Thomas says that's all the more reason.
Well, I think they'd take a chunk of a Best Buy because a Best Buy store generates a lot of traffic in its own right. And so just moving into an empty building, you wouldn't necessarily have that.
Towsley says a big box has to choose tenants that won't dilute or compete with its own brand. That's been a challenge for Sears, another retailer trying subleasing to help pay the bills. Morningstar's R.J. Hatavi says even if the strategy works for Best Buy, it's only buying time.
Ultimately, we do see store closures. We don't think the subleasing is going to be enough to offset the pressures that are currently facing the company.
It all adds up to the new mantra of the big box: smaller is better. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
Egypt took a not insubstantial step toward getting its economy back on track yesterday. The transitional government in Cairo has passed a budget for the 2011 fiscal year, which starts at the end of the month. Our series, Economy 4.0, is an ongoing study in getting economies back on track and in how to get the global financial system to work better for more people. In Dubai, in the United Arab Emirates, they are still trying to figure out how to match commerce with economic opportunity. Our special correspondent David Brancaccio reports now from Dubai.
In the UAE, it's one country, two sets of rules for business. It's like air travel. There's the regular treatment, or, if you meet the criteria, short lines and free drinks. Let's start with the regular business treatment. Guess what animal? Sheep with a head cold? Answer, camel. 4,000 of them in a state-of-the-art dairy in the desert outside the city of Dubai. Camelicious does camel milk in plain, date, saffron, and more. When German-born Ulrich Wernery became convinced of the positive health effects of camel milk, he knew he needed to bring in a UAE citizen to get the job done.
I was with him on a flight to UK, so he could not escape. So I told him everything what I knew about camel milk and said, "Sir, let's do a dairy."
Wernery didn't mess around. He was pitching the boss, the ruler of Dubai, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum. In most of the UAE, foreigners with a business idea are required by law to take on a UAE partner who will own at least 51% of the company. Even if it's just a branch office, a foreign business still needs a UAE sponsor. Siju Chan of Expat Assist can set it up.
It's just like a real estate business. I mean, you get in people together and make sure that everyone's happy.
You know what you are? You're a broker, but you're also like a matchmaker.
That's right. A matchmaker really does the job.
In the standard-issue Emirates business climate, foreigners who want access to the inside of this oil-rich market have to share the bounty by playing ball with locals. But there is another business ecosystem for businesses serving foreign markets from the UAE.
What's up, Dubai?
Where this man moved his business after 15 years producing TV in London.
And my little crossover, the bridge I've used in the Middle East, is stand-up comedy, putting that on TV.
How's that working?
It's mushrooming. I used the word exploding in the past, but that's not exactly the best connotation in the Middle East.
Did he really say that out loud? Jamil Abu Warda set up his production company in one of the UAE's many so-called free zones, in one designed especially for media companies. He pays flat fees to do business here, but there are no taxes, even if big profits roll in.
If you're going to be making a million, you're not going to be taxed on a million.
There are also free trade zones for internet companies, another for factories, product distribution centers, and more. And businesses from all over the world are relocating to this almost libertarian paradise with its soft-touch government oversight and no requirement for UAE ownership.
But what does the local emirate or the country as a whole get out of it, since there are effectively no import, export, personal, or corporate taxes? Lots of spin-offs, says Jamal Al-Sharif, who runs a free zone called Dubai Media City.
You know, you're going to be using the airlines, you're going to be using the hotels, your partners are going to be using the accommodation. So that helps the growth of the economy of Dubai, and that's how Dubai government actually looks at it.
They also help draw expertise to the country, be it how to run an internet company or how to make a situation comedy.
They're a way to accelerate development, but ultimately successful free zones need to link back to the real economy.
Omar Sawaya with the consulting firm A.T. Kearney in Dubai says free zones from the UAE to Egypt and beyond should be seen as a stage in a progression.
So that over time, the notion of free zone disappears and it becomes really part of the overall economy of a country.
It's been a year when so many people around the Middle East are demanding the right to participate in their countries politically and economically. The Arab Spring is a reminder that sticking so much of the economic fun into special zones for foreigners may not be a sustainable long-term plan. In Dubai, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, let's call it a chance to test your marketing prognostication skills. The website 24/7 Wall Street has come out with a list of well-known brand names it thinks are simply going to disappear in 2012. Just go away. It's a thing they do every year, apparently, and they have been right in the past and wrong. So here's the list for next year. Sears, conceivably. Sony Pictures, I think that's going to stay. American Apparel, Nokia, Saab, they had some bad news today. A&W All-American Foods Restaurants. To be honest, I thought they were already gone. Soap Opera Digest, ditto. Sony Ericsson, I don't know, MySpace, that's probably going to stick around. Also, Kellogg's Corn Pops. I don't know that that fits the definition of big brand name, but whatever. Our brand name is Marketplace. It's from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow finished off 59 points, about a half of 1%. The NASDAQ rose 17 points, two-thirds of 1%. The S&P 500 ticked down 3 points, a quarter of 1%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time back here, how to serve a sport to kids.
Hit the ball and stay focused on the ball and not let it go out of the line.
Tennis, anyone? I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.